Ladies and gentlemen, it is Thursday, March the 9th, 1:02 p.m. here on the west coast of the United States. My name is Arthur Asadurian. This is the Apogia Center interview portions where we bring on guests. And it's been a number of weeks where we haven't done this on Thursdays because of all sorts of crazy issues. But finally, we're on track. We were supposed to have today's guest on, I think, a month ago or something like that. But again, things have happened, so I'm really, really excited to have this conversation. But before we get into this, as is common to our YouTube world, hit that like button because it helps. And our guest is a fellow YouTuber. He knows what's up. We're going to have a phenomenal conversation. And yes, we will define terms because, as I've said before, I think like 70% of doing philosophy is definitions, if you want to do it well. Let me give a little introduction, and then we're going to bring our guest on and then talk to him, get to know him a little bit, and then jump into the subject as well. Parker Sedekase is a staff member on the Chicago Athletes in Action team. He's earned two master's degrees from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. One of them was in systematic theology and the other one in theological studies. He's currently finishing up his third master's degree. This should tell you something about our guest. And this master's degree is in philosophy of religion from Palm Beach Atlantic University, which I think is one of the best philosophy programs for Christians up and coming. I shouldn't even say up and coming. It's up in the country. If you're on the West Coast, you might think about Talbot. If you're on the East Coast in Florida, this is what you want to look at. And he's the host of Parker's Penzies podcast, where he has discussions with leading philosophers and theologians about life's deepest questions. We're going to bring Parker on and say, what's up, Parker? How you doing, brother?
Hey, man. Hey, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So before we get going, tell us about the fantabulous mustache, bro.
I started growing the mustache as a way to keep women away from me. I was doing a year of singleness because I had all jacked up history. And one of my mentors was like, bro, you just need to take a chill, just back off and don't even pursue any women for a year. So I was like, all right, well, this is a perfect time to grow a mullet and a mustache. And that kind of, it grew on me, right? But I actually kind of liked it.
It started attracting the women.
Well, it attracted the right woman. So it attracted my wife. Her father had a mustache her whole life, and he has a twin brother. So she's seen mustaches from men that she loves her whole life. So I was like, finally, I found the one. This is it. Let's get married. And here we are today.
God's sovereignty.
That's right, man. Amen.
That is interesting, right? You like start something up and then you're like, whoa, how did this happen? Right. Yep. Parker, you're getting your third master's degree. And usually when we jump into these podcasts, these interviews, I like to pick the brains of folks in regards to, or the minds. We'll talk a little bit about that, I guess.
Amen. That's right. That's right.
I should rephrase that. How you've done it. Now, you're finishing up a third master's degree. And then why you haven't done a PhD? Because that's just strange. Usually people will do one master's and then get a PhD that includes a master's sometimes.
Yeah,
but to do three and potentially do a PhD, that's quite a bit of your life dedicated to study. And then just like practically how you've got like remained sane, had a normal life, job, gotten married, all that stuff. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So I always prided myself on being the like self-taught guy. I started taking my faith more seriously my junior year of college, and I would read a bunch of theology books on my own, apologetics books. And I really liked talking with seminarians and then being like, oh, dude, where do you go to school? I'm like, nowhere, bro. I'm self-taught. And people kept on like, it was really arrogant and prideful, right? But people kept on saying, you should go to seminary. You should go to seminary. And I was like, well, you know, if God pays for it, I will. But I'm not taking on any school debt. I finally, you know, paid that crap off. And then I met my current wife. And I found out right before we got married that, she works at Trinity. Trinity International University. She works in the undergrad. And I didn't know this at the time, but we found out that since she works in the undergrad, I can go to the graduate school for free once we're married because she'd worked there for so long. So we moved on campus there and I got to have 100% tuition off. Like, so that was insane. So I ended up, they said you can have 8 free semesters or 1 free degree. So I did 6 semesters and I got 2 free degrees and didn't tell anybody. And just kind of holding my, you know, crossing my fingers that they would send me 2 diplomas.
Don't find out.
That's right. But they, I took like 94 credits for free and just crushed it. Took some Greek, took some Hebrew, went all over the place. Wrote a master's thesis under Kevin Van Hooser and John Feinberg. It was amazing. It was awesome experience. But it was all free. So I'm like, look, God did pay for it. I better work hard at this. So I didn't sleep very much for those years. I was some semesters I was taking 19 credit hours, but all the work prior to that, the self-taught stuff just paid off. A lot of my friends were in seminary when I wasn't. And so I would ask them how many pages they read a week and they would tell me. So I would just do that myself. So then by the time I got to seminary, I was already prepared. I knew the lingo. I was ready to go. I knew which papers I wanted to write and just jumped in. Like, I loved it. A lot of people have a hard time with it, especially if you want to be a pastor. Sometimes you're like, why do I need to read Herman Bavinck? I don't understand this. But for me, I'm like, I don't care, but I just want to be a theologian, man. I want to get into it. And the more I studied theology, the more I realized I don't want to be a theologian who talks about philosophy and doesn't know what he's talking about.
Mm.
And I realized more and more, I want to be a philosopher.
You're speaking to my heart right there.
That's right. So then I realized, man, I want to be a theologian and a philosopher. Like, I want to bring those two together, but I don't want to be a philosopher who does theology or a theologian does. I want to know the disciplines well.
Philosophical theology, man. That's it.
Yeah.
You get best of both worlds, I suppose. I mean, I did my bachelor's degree in biblical studies, and that was like probably the greatest gift to my Christian life because I didn't just do theology. I studied how to like study the text. So I love the text of the Bible and hermeneutics. When I studied philosophy, it was a foreign language. I was like, I have no idea what's going on. I'd taken like one philosophy class before, in Bible college. But then you learn it, and it's hard, and you go through the grinder. But it helps so much when you're doing theology to know your philosophy.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you get your terms all properly defined and correct, and then you know how to go around that. How old are you?
I'm 31. Yeah.
You're one of those guys. I'm 30. I'm turning 38 this year. No, it's just it's
you don't look like it, man. Hilarious. You could look 28 to me. I don't know.
That's cuz my beard's not long. Whenever it's long, people are like, "Are you 45?" yeah. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And you used to be a wrestler as well.
That's right. And I work primarily with wrestlers in my Athletes in Action ministry. At Northwestern, I was doing the ministry the whole time while I was at TEDS and currently. And I think you said you were full time in ministry when you were in school,
correct?
Right?
Yeah.
I love that. I think it helps so much because sometimes if you're just studying for a test, it sometimes is in one ear, one out the other. But if you're sitting down with someone, they're like, what are you studying this week? And you're like, how do I tell you about disagreement literature and epistemology right now? Like, okay. And you have to explain it to them and actually helps you learn it better. So if you have to explain it to a college kid or a high schooler or whoever, your parents, like it helps you metabolize it. And I think if I didn't have ministry, I probably would have dropped out of seminary and philosophy because it wouldn't have been as fun for me. I wouldn't have learned it as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's such a great advantage. I noticed that with my classmates and no dig at them because they actually got to spend quite a bit of time in the library where I didn't. And I probably could have gotten better grades if I wasn't in ministry. Yeah. But is it like practically I was applying everything I was learning in ministry. Yeah. And I did that with my bachelor's in biblical studies and my master's. And again, I just generally tell people, if you're learning something, find a group of folks that you can sit with and then like process that through or even disciple them or teach them, you're going to learn it 1,000 times better.
Yeah. Amen.
There's a couple of questions that have come in and I want to answer it because I know the people asking it. And then I did a little reading about your position on some of this stuff. I think they'd be happy. But before that, you also run a YouTube channel.
That's right.
Called Parker's Penzies. Now you interview folks, we spoke about that, but you're producing really good content, man. I mean, like some of the folks you have on is like high quality philosophy stuff. It's brilliant. How's that? And then just everywhere else people can find you. I've linked all your stuff, well, at least your website and your YouTube channel in the description box. But tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, yeah. So while I was at TED's, I just, God gives me favor with people, which is cool. And it comes from ministry. I know how to talk with people, and that's my whole job. So I just apply that to my professors, and I would go to their office hours all the time and just bug. I bugged Van Hooser often, like very, very often. But people, like, they like me because I'm a personable, because of all the work that I do in ministry. God has blessed me, and it's it's great. It's a great thing. But I was realizing, like, I was having all these friendships with professors, and meanwhile, Jordan Peterson is exploding in the media. And, you know, I've been following him since 2016, and seeing, like, Peterson just go off. And I was like, all my professors could give way better answers than Peterson. Oh, yeah. I like him. But I'm like, man, I wish Van Hooser stuff would pop off like this. So I actually started the podcast with Kevin Van Hooser in mind. And he still hasn't come on my podcast. So everyone get at him, tell him to come on. But I started because I made all these friends with professors. And I was like, you guys have really good work. And it sucks that three people will read your journal article when it's so cool and it's so deep and it can help people understand their lives. So I started the podcast in order to bring top shelf stuff out of the academy, and not necessarily to bring the, you know, top shelf cookies down, but to bring my audience up. Come on up. Correct. Into it, and just listen to it. And if you don't understand something, go read a book on it and Google some words, but let's get an education. Come on in. So that's really been the goal. It's Parker's Pensies. Started because I had a blog by the same name. I know it's pronounced Ponce's, but I'm an American swine. I would feel like, you know, like a middle-aged white lady at a Mexican restaurant who's like, gracias, thank you. Like, no, just say thank you. It's cool, you know? So I don't pronounce it because I don't speak French. But I have a Substack that I've been meaning to work on a little bit more, but that's kind of my own philosophical thoughts. And I just started adding some more tips and tricks from grad school for grad students on my YouTube channel, how to read more books, how to journal like a philosopher, stuff like that.
Yeah, I actually just like an hour and a half ago, I watched your video on reading.
Oh, cool,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, man. And because I struggle with them, and I'm one of those guys that's like in like 10 books at a time. And then I forget, and then I got to go back and read. But it was a really good video. I'm actually... I was like, let me do this interview, and I'm going to share it with our men's group.
Sweet.
Because there's guys who are like, oh, man, I want to read, but I'm not disciplined, or I don't like reading, or something like that. Yeah. And, I mean, I read like 3.5 books throughout high school. I was a horrible student.
But, same with me, man.
Christian, when I became a Christian, and that's what you were saying.
You're like, that's what he does, bro. God grabs a hold of you, and is like, you're going to start reading now.
Correct.
But it's the same... Yeah, it's the same thing, you know, the same guys who are super jacked and they're very regimented with their lifting programs are like, yeah, I can't read. And you're like, why don't you just make a schedule like you do with your lifting program? Like, you know how to program way better than I do. Go and do that with your books. And if you read 5 pages and that's it, so what? Who cares? No one's looking over your shoulder judging you. Just go do it.
Yeah.
So that's because of the wrestler mentality. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Cool. Yeah. Okay. Let's jump into this because this is a very, very interesting subject. Simulation hypothesis versus Christian theism. I forgot. Sorry. I got to get back to this. Someone asked if you're a Molinist.
No, I'm not. Some people might want to
tell us a little about that, because I think it'll make this person happy who's asking this question.
Oh, so I am a Calvinist myself. I did my master's thesis on defending Kevin Van Hooser's model of God from the problem of evil. And it's the authorial analogy for the God-world relation. Those who have ears, let them hear. I'll just toss that out for everyone. But it's a model of God saying God relates to the world in an analogous fashion that a author relates to their novel. C.S. Lewis uses this. Lots of Arminians and Calvinists use this.
Correct.
I think the Molinists actually they're behind the show here. They need to jump on it. And, you know, they can say it's a choose-your-own-adventure story or something like that, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. That's not bad.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm a theological determinist, but I think the type of determinism really, really matters. And then the type of author that God is really matters for us to be held morally responsible. Mm-hmm. And I try to cash it out in reasons responsiveness for those who are familiar with philosophy, free will type stuff. So, yeah, that's me, man. It's a whole thing. I am and I am not. It's really tricky. I do not like internet preceptors that often.
I get it.
It's just it's tough, man. I'm like holding out, right? I'm like, dude, if we can do the transcendental argument, awesome. That's cool. Depending on how we actually interpret Romans 1, that's kind of a big deal that a lot of preceptors don't get into. And then it's just kind of, there's a lot of big claims that get thrown around, which you study philosophy and you're like, impossibility of the contrary. Impossibility? What do you mean? What kind of impossibility are we talking here? That's a big claim, you know? So depends, man. Yeah, it's a tricky one.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's very interesting because I don't necessarily have issues with presuppositionist arguments. I mean, I don't think anybody really does, but a certain sort of folks, I guess, I have issues with. But I think like historic presuppositionism is something that could be very highly respected. I think you see it in church history. And if people can distinguish between ontological and epistemological presuppositionalism, I think that's going to be generally helpful in this discussion. But that's not our discussion today.
That's right.
And I want to learn quite a bit on this because obviously I've heard about it, done a little bit of research and thinking about it, but not like really in-depth stuff. But it's really cool considering the way technology is advancing and then what people are pontificating, you can say, about the future. So before we get going, tell us what the simulation hypothesis is, and then we'll go from there.
Cool. So I get this comes up to me all the time because I work in campus ministry at Northwestern, and a lot of my bros listen to Joe Rogan and Lex Friedman. And they used to talk about it a lot more. They don't talk about it as much, but they used to talk about the simulation hypothesis. What if we're all living in a computer simulation? Mm-hmm. And like at its core, that's what's up. What if we're all living in a computer simulation? And you say, well, what do you mean? Like the Matrix? Well, you can't answer that because then it jumps into different versions. So just like the core is that we live in some sort of computer simulation. If you look for this online, it's called simulation theory. If you talk to people in the academy, it's simulation hypothesis. So that's one kind of difference. If someone starts throwing around theory, you know they're kind of more at the popular level. And then there's various different conceptions of it. There's a popular book by a computer, MIT computer scientist. Yeah, he makes computer games. I don't know what you call that person, a video game engineer or something. Riz von Werk is his name, and he's got a popular book, The Simulation Hypothesis. His conception is more like the Matrix, that where something like a brain in a vat, though he doesn't go with the skeptical hypothesis, but there's some kind of existence outside of the simulation that we have. He wants to use that in a syncretist kind of way to bring all the religions together and to use it as a explanation for, as a theory of everything, joining fundamental physics and, you know, broad scale, big physics. So why do electrons, why do they look like particles when we observe them, but why do they look like waves when we're not? Well, because it's a wave when no one's looking at it because it's not rendered, right? Why would you want to render? If it's like in a video game, you don't need to render anything behind you if you're not looking at it. So that's weird, right? But that it's supposed to be an explanation of everything. That's popular level stuff. Riz von Werk is not a philosopher. When you talk to the philosophers who think about it, usually it's following Nick Bostrom. He's got a 2001 paper. I think it was republished in 2003. Are You Living in a Computer Simulation? I believe is the name. There's so many articles by these names now. I have like three of them that it's all the same title or mixed up. So something like that. He's got a website like simulation.com maybe or .org. But his is a really careful, nuanced argument on going in on a Bayesian style argument that just says one of three premises are true. One is that we will never be able to make a simulated world with simulated conscious beings that have the qualitative experience we have. We're just never going to be able to make it. Maybe we'll go extinct before then. We'll blow each other up. And that's kind of his thing. He thinks about futuristic stuff like that. Two is, the second proposition is, we can, and we may be able to make those, but we won't for moral reasons, because maybe we'll decide it's really immoral to bring all these beings into existence. There's kind of like an anti-natalist type argument there where, you know, it might be wrong to bring beings into the world, right? And then the third option is we are most likely already living in a computer simulation. And that, it seems quick, right? But he goes to explain it by saying, that's the simulation hypothesis. That's the third one. So this is called the simulation argument. If you don't have a good reason for thinking that one or two is true, then you should affirm the third one, which is the simulation hypothesis. So this is a simulation argument, these three propositions. That's it kind of in a nutshell, as I've seen it on the popular level. It's kind of a fuzzier notion. What if we're computer beings? What if we're a brain in a vat? Those kind of go together and you kind of press on it and people don't really know where they're at, but it's usually kind of a smokescreen. If you're talking theism, you're talking design arguments, you go, yeah, well, what if we're just, you know, in some kid's video game? You're like, well, what does that mean? What do you mean by that? I'm like, well, I don't know. What if, bro? But in the philosophical community, a lot of the out there thinkers, the really abstract dudes who I love that kind of stuff. I don't like the practical stuff. They're like, yeah, this is the live option. This is really fascinating. And whether or not we can have evidence for simulation hypothesis will depend on who you ask. And I can give, you know, different reasons for why or why not. But that's kind of the two camps that I've seen, popular and academic level.
In what issues does this view solve? Let's ask it. Let's approach it that way before we get into Christian theism or whatever idealism and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So what is it that it actually solves? Because I'll tell you why. I don't know who this was, but a while back I was doing some research on this, and then I came across a German, it was an academic thing, it was a German scientist, as far as I remember, who was giving a talk, and he got up there and said, we've been doing physics wrong. Mm-hmm. What we've been doing is we start with material things, and what we should have started with was information. And then he read the first verse of the Gospel of John, which I was shocked at, and he was like, in the beginning was the Logos. Like, this is information. That's where we need to start with this. So how does it help scientifically? If true, what does it solve? And then we'll talk about potential issues and how theologically we can reconcile this or whatever.
Yeah. So it depends on who you're asking. And the popular level, it could solve a lot of stuff. In a world view without God, it could solve everything you need God for. So why did Donald Trump win the 2016 election? Like, it looked like he was totally not going to win. Mm-hmm. Well, the simulators thought, like, well, let's see what would happen in this one if it did happen. Maybe they're running an app or something. Let's see how crazy that would have been. And so people point to synchronicity type stuff, where it's like things that look like they're too coincidental to be like just happenstance. You know, starting of World War One, like, how did the Archduke Franz Ferdinand like turn down the wrong road? Like, what are you talking about? There's no way. So a lot of people point to that or synchronicity in their own life. And that's like a Jungian term. But it's like that, but theists just call that providence. We're like, yeah, dude, God is at work in the world. And they're like, oh no, the simulator's at work in the world. And you're like, oh, okay. So it explains that kind of stuff if you don't have a God in your worldview. But like I said, like Virk will point to syncretist type stuff where it's like, hey, all these religions talking about a more real, more fundamental reality, Plato talking about escaping from the cave, they've all been gesturing at the fact that we live in a computer simulation. They just didn't have those concepts yet. And now that we do, we can explain this more deeply, and we can maybe even see that we're all worshiping the same thing, or we're all been pointing at the same thing. So Virk will go in on that, and he'll say it's a theory of everything, that like this can unify physics. So there's that on the really popular level. There's like Reddit pages like Glitch in the Matrix and stuff like that, where you just see weird stuff happening in the world and you're like, dude, there's no way. Nope, we live in the Matrix. We live in a digital world. So it does some explanatory stuff there. On the philosophical, like in the academy, I think it's just a really fun puzzle to think about. And like Dustin Crummett is a theist, and I don't think he believes, I know he doesn't believe in the simulation hypothesis, but he wrote a paper where he tries to collapse natural evils down to moral evils through the simulation hypothesis. So if we do live in a simulated world, like hurricanes and stuff like that, well, what's the deal? Those are kind of hard to explain if you like to just focus on the free will defense. Well, you can use the free will defense if we live in a computer simulation. It's not God's fault. It's the simulator's fault. He simulated a bad world that we live in. Mm. So there's stuff like that. And then, yeah, it's different ways to cash out. Well, it's a different model of God. It can be a different model of God in philosophy of religion circles. So yeah, man, there's a bunch. Depending on who you're asking, like, we can go all over the place.
Okay. So the way we phrase this interview is that it is the simulation hypothesis versus Christian theism. Yeah. But before we get to the verses aspect, there are Christians who think that God is ultimately, like, God's mind is the one generating this reality or some sort of thing like that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I should say that this stuff's really not new in regards to philosophical discourse. It's like reality not being reality, brain in a vat argument you mentioned. You mentioned Plato and Allegory of the Cave. It's just that since the, I guess, invention of computer games, and then also it's not just the invention of computer games, as far as I remember, it's the invention of a certain kind of computer games. I remember when, and I'm forgetting, Assassin's Creed came out and you were able to like ride your horse to the next town.
Yeah.
And stuff was being generated. It was like phenomenal, right?
Yeah.
It's you're seeing that and you go, oh, wait, what if reality is that? What if it's just continuously being generated? So we have
it's massively multiplayer. Yeah, massively. I forgot, like Morgues or something like that. Hmm. Massively multiplayer games where like the world is there and you can sign on and play with other people. World of Warcraft type stuff.
Yeah.
Like you were saying, but you can go somewhere and there is like an actual kind of digital space. You can be like, go meet me here. And you're talking through your headset to somebody and you're like, oh, wait, what if that, what the heck? What if I, when I say go meet me at 7-Eleven, what if that's the same case, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So we just have more tools, I guess, speaking about this. The idea is not that, and idealism has been, you know, a part of this conversation, I guess. Can you give us a little breakdown of what idealism is and then what Christians think about this, or some Christians?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it all depends, but I guess since you study philosophy, your audience will know that it all depends on what you mean by it. Like, that's what a good philosopher ought to say. I think probably it might be hard to demarcate idealism, just all of them together, but it's something like reality is thoughts, you know, whether we all exist in someone's mind or the mind of God. Or whether or not like the fundamental particles turn out to be like thoughts instead of, you know, and maybe conjoining that with information theory. And so you say, look, everything is information ultimately. And well, it's God's information, but it's in his thoughts. And whether that's univocal or analogical, that's another conversation. But fundamentally, it's hard, dude, because you can have idealism where like, Berkeleyan idealism, I believe, would have an external world, but it has to be like perceived by God. To be is to be perceived, right? That's his famous thing. But then there's also like Hasidic idealism, where like the world just exists in God's mind, and it's like a panentheism light, where it's like, yeah, the world is not God's body or anything like that, like a real strong panentheism, but it does exist in God. It's just in his mind, and he's thinking, we are his thoughts. So that's not pantheism, because God doesn't have to be his thoughts. Maybe his thoughts are different than him. And so therefore, boom, we're not God. So that's idealism. Idealism is like ideas are most fundamental, most real, something like that to cash out idealism. So it's been around for a while. And like you said, a lot of people jumping on the computer stuff in order to just explicate idealism. Right. And say like, yeah, at bottom, we've always, the idealists were right. It's just now we have the conceptual tools to flesh it out a little bit deeper.
Okay. Does this in any way, you think, cause issues theologically? Like, obviously there are Christians who believe this.
Hmm.
Right. Or some form of it.
Sure.
Like, can they still remain orthodox, you would say, in regards to their view of God and hold to it? I'll stop there and then we'll.
Well, yeah, again, dude, it depends. So, a lot of theologians will bemoan like the whole theological language debate type stuff in the I don't know 50s and 60s, where everyone was talking about like analogy and univocity and metaphorical language about God. We need it. We need to bring it back because it actually does matter. If you think that the simulation hypothesis is a good metaphor for how God relates to the world, okay. Well, metaphors are like are literally false, right? So like if I was like, Arthur's a fox, dude, look at that dude's beard. That dude's a fox. That's literally not true. You are literally not a fox. But metaphorically, I'm making a point that you're a handsome guy, right? So yeah, sure. Like God is not a simulator, literally, but it might do some a little tiny bit of lifting to think of him as that in order to think of his relation to creation. So that's one. If you think of it analogically, that's going to be much stronger. And that's what I did my work on with God as the author of the world. I think that's a very strong analogy, and I think it holds really strongly. In that sense, I'm saying God is literally an author, but not in a univocal sense to Tolkien. God doesn't write with pen and paper always, right? He didn't create like. So if you're saying that God is like God is analogical to a simulator, okay, again, it's a stronger case than the metaphor. So you might need to do a little bit more work to show that that's orthodox and stuff, but okay, cool. I think we can probably work with that. If you're saying in an equivocal fashion, who cares? It doesn't, then what are you even saying? Like, you're just saying God and there's no connection. So who cares? But if you're saying that God is univocally a simulator, like a human being, like you're saying that he created a computer and then generated the world from the computer, like, I don't think that one's orthodox. If you think that God is what the word that we use, God, refers to a human, one level of reality deeper than us, that's not orthodox. If you think it refers to an alien, any kind of like, I would say contingent being, but maybe like Swinburne might be like, well, God's not a necessary being. I think Swinburne's wrong on that, though. Yeah. That's a terrifying thing to say, right? I understand. I'm down here. Right. But I think if you think that that word refers to a contingent being who created univocally in the same way, like who created the universe through a computer, yeah, that's not orthodox. You know, that's not. So we need to have arguments for that. I think we have very good arguments against that. I think that if you believe we live in a computer simulation created by a contingent being like us, then you should believe in God, because I think you can run contingency arguments right through that human simulator. I think you can run arguments from abstracta right through that simulator. So, you know, even if we're 1,000 levels down in the simulation, I think our theistic arguments can still shoot us all the way back up to God. Yeah.
Yeah. Someone asked this, so I want to give him credit, but I was kind of having the same sort of thought of how this becomes problematic when it comes to the incarnation.
Maybe.
And like how that could be solved.
Dude, maybe. Yeah. Go ahead.
If there's a simulation and God created it, and then, I mean, when you read scripture at face value, it's very clear that God took on human flesh in a very real sense. I mean, so I think Chalcedonian Creed, fully God, fully man. He enters the simulation, and how that would work out and look, or whether that would cause some issues, like in regards to its orthodoxy. I mean, it wouldn't necessarily be that it's unorthodox, but it could be, or heretical. It wouldn't be heretical, maybe, but it'd be like a bit unorthodox or something like that.
So maybe not, though. So I think it's Catherine Tanner. It's one of the Cathys in theology. I think it's Catherine Tanner. She wrote this paper where she gives an analogy for the incarnation through video games. And she calls this guy Video Game Nick. There's Nick in the real world, and there's Video Game Nick. And when someone walks into the house and is like, Nick, where are you at today? If he's like, I'm on the couch, you're like, yeah, dude, duh. I mean, in the video game, where are you at? So it's one person with two natures. One is in base reality on the couch. The other is somewhere in, Halo on a warthog somewhere. And it's the same person. It's got two different natures. So some people think this is a really good way to actually cash out the incarnation.
Interesting.
I actually like that one a lot. I think it's
great. Yeah, that's really very interesting. I'm just trying to process it.
Yeah. So I actually really like that. I think a harder problem, and I'll let you process that too if you want to come back to it or whatever. I mean, it's your show. You do whatever you want. But if we are simulated beings and they simulated the Bible into our simulation, does Christ's sacrifice still cover simulated beings as well as, you know, base reality beings? If there's like a base reality human and God came incarnated in the person of Jesus Christ and died for the sins of anyone who trusts in him, does that include me? I'm a simulated being. And so part of me is like, hey, look, I think this extent of the atonement can cover that for sure. I don't think there's a limitation, but do I count as being an image bearer of God? And it's kind of tricky to flesh out what it means to be an image bearer of God. But let's say like I'm made in the image of someone in base reality. seems like that might there might be a transitivity going on of Imago Dei. Maybe that image transfers all the way to me. And if I trust in Jesus in the simulation, then maybe I'm covered.
Yeah. So just want to take a couple of steps back for those who are watching and they're like, I just lost you guys. If you've seen The Matrix, right? So think Neo in The Matrix and then Neo when he wakes up in that womb, right? Like that's the sort of stuff, like the stuff that Neo is doing in there, let's just say. It's in his mind. I'm assuming that's what we're talking about, right? Like, so...
So we had two things going on, right?
Okay.
We talked about the incarnation would be like Neo exists in the Matrix and he exists outside the Matrix, right?
Correct.
So that would be like Christ coming down to Earth. He didn't like give up his divinity, right? He didn't stop being God. He was one person with two natures. So I think the loose metaphor or analogy there is like Neo entering into the Matrix. He still has a physical existence in base reality and can do all the things that he can do there. But he also has this new nature in the digital world where he can do different things. He's got different properties.
So that's
still same person.
What I wrote down is like this issue of like properties. It's like, because you spoke about image of God and what makes us human. And if we're talking about the incarnation, we believe Jesus is fully human. It's like the properties in the simulation, would those be like appropriately applied, I guess?
Well, so, okay. So the analogy, the incarnation analogy, the video game analogy is like brain in a vat, Matrix, different than like the fully Sims simulated world where you and I would just be a digital like token or something.
Mm-hmm.
So in the Matrix view, like when you go into the Matrix, Neo has hair. He's got like this like beautiful haircut. When he leaves the Matrix, he's bald. So he's got different properties.
Thing on the back.
Right. So he's got different properties qua base reality and qua the Matrix. But yet he's still the same person. He's just got, you know, he's got different properties. He's truly a human in the digital world. And so it's an analogy, so it does break down because he's human in both places, right? But he does have different abilities and different properties in different worlds.
Correct. And he can hack it, I suppose some of these guys would talk about miracles in that sort of a way.
What do you mean? Yeah, what do you mean?
So like, Neo is able to hack the Matrix and do a bunch of stuff, like download
martial
arts,
sure.
Right?
Sure. Yeah.
He just knows this stuff.
Yeah.
And in this scenario, talk about miracles like that.
Right. Well, imagine if Neo made the Matrix, like how much more power would he have to hack the system and stuff, right? And that's what we see in John 1, that, you know, the Logos stepped into his own world. So like, why is it surprising that this being who created this universe by his word why is it surprising that he uses his word to calm a storm? Like, he created everything with that word. Why can he not just be still, right? Like. Yeah, it's crazy.
Cool. Okay, so let's move on to the second aspect of this, the versus Christian theism.
Yeah. Yeah, so the versus, it comes up a little bit like a smokescreen, right? Like if you're talking with someone on campus and, I don't know, maybe you're giving them evidence for God and for the resurrection or something like that, and they go, yeah, what if we live in a computer simulation? And I used to just like go at it. I used to be like, well, no, here's some reasons why we don't live in a computer simulation. You know, you got brain in a vat arguments, or you got arguments against like machine functionalism theories of mind. And you say, look, you know, machine functionalism is false for this and this reason. Therefore, we can't be digital conscious beings. Therefore, you know, we got to stay with God. But I started, it's pretty tough to talk with someone about machine functionalism just on
campus.
Just
for the sake of all of us, give us a brief definition of what machine functionalism is.
Yeah, so functionalism is a theory of like, it's a theory of mind, it's a theory of consciousness, kind of. What it means to be a mind, a conscious being, is just a series of inputs and outputs and internal states. So Alan Turing, super famous dude, super really smart dude, like invented computers. He came up with this idea of a machine named after him, a Turing machine, where you have an input and this input comes into the machine and there's internal states, just call them states. It doesn't matter that much. Like M1, we'll call it like a mental state, and then M2, another mental state. So an input comes in, M1 switches to M2, and when it switches to M2, it makes a certain output. That's it. And I know it sounds simple. That's it. That's all that a Turing machine is. So these functionalists say that's what it is to be us. We're just realized Turing machines. We get inputs and our mental states switch from M1 to M2, whatever, pain states. And then we have an output and we say, ouch. So a lot of people will say the simulation hypothesis as proposed by Nick Bostrom, who is, you know, definitely the most famous philosopher who's worked on this, that's wedded to this machine functionalist view. You're like, so if that view is false, then the simulation hypothesis goes out the window. So I used to spend all my time arguing against that and saying like, no, there's so many reasons why machine functionalism is false. Robots made in a computational way can't have understanding. You can go with John Searle's Chinese Room or Ned Block's Chinese Nation argument. So no, machines can't think, therefore we can't be a machine is basically the argument.
Part of this, wouldn't it necessitate determinism if this is true?
Yeah, why think that?
I'm supposing if it's just inputs and then the outputs are just going to be that, it seems to me that free will.
I think you could toss in some like indeterminacy. Maybe it's an indeterminist rule that like, 90% of the time or something like that.
Some kind of probability thing in there.
Yeah. I know how the libertarians like to use the indeterminacy. So you could totally do that. Toss that in there. Right.
Okay.
So that's that. That's machine functionalism. There's reasons to think that's false. I used to go with that route, but now I like to push people a little bit more and just go like, so I give them arguments for God. They say, what if we're living in a computer simulation? I go, why would that disprove Christianity? Like, help me see that, right? Help me see why that's so
before
a problem.
We get there, I want the audience to know that this is a good approach in regards to your evangelism and apologetics. Okay. So because part of doing apologetics well is that you want the conversation to continue and you want to be able to use whatever you can to communicate the gospel to the person in front of you. So I actually think this is what John is doing in John 1. He's taking this idea that already exists. This is Logos idea in contemporary culture and philosophy and thought. And says, hey, you guys are familiar with this. Let me tell you. And then he redefines it quite a bit, not entirely, and then speaks about Jesus.
Yeah.
So instead of just going, doing a Tertullian, right? Like philosophy is from the devil and, it's wrong.
Paul does the same thing, right? Paul says, here, let me grab this unknown God.
Correct.
Hey, what you worship is unknown. Let me make known to you.
So you make a connection there and you say, let's just say you're right. Does that necessarily mean Christianity is false, God doesn't exist?
Yeah, because I used to just jump on it and I'd be like, okay, I see the entailments here, let's just jump on with you. But now I'm like, well, wait, flesh that out for me a little bit more. And like you said, I want to continue the conversation. I don't want to just slam you into the ground. I don't want it. That's not good. That doesn't help the gospel go forward. It doesn't help me get to know anybody. It's not that fun after all. Like when you do that a couple of times, you're like, look, I've studied this stuff way more than you, and it's actually not fair for me to do that, and it doesn't feel good. Like, if you were, like, my intellectual peer, and you studied as much as I studied, and we went back and forth, that's fun, but it's not fun for me to go and try to, like, lure you into traps and beat you up and then say, like, I'm an apologist.
Correct.
Like, I want to actually talk to you about Christ, so let's lure you into that.
It would be the same if me and you got in a ring together.
Yeah, you'd beat me up.
I have zero. Right. Zero martial arts. I don't know whether you play soccer or not, but
it would come back, dude. Generations of generations in your blood, I'm sure.
I know, huh? Imagine going all the way back. The Armenian wrestling thing kicks in and I turn into.
Yeah, that's right, dude.
Yeah, I highly doubt that.
But that's what I'm saying. I love that you said that because I feel the exact same way. I want to have a conversation. I actually like talking about this stuff and I like raising problems for my own view and I want to pull you in. So you help me tell me why is this a problem for Christianity? And then you're having a theological conversation and you're trying to understand Christianity. Now you're the one explaining to me the Christianity. And I go, wait, that's not what Christians believe. Oh, wait, no, let's talk. Let's jump in. Oh, that's an interesting point. Now we're being human beings talking to each other instead of me trying to lure you into a trap.
Yeah. Got a good question here that just popped up. And it is reality a simulation only understandable as a computer, quote unquote, or simulation, computer simulation, or is there some other sense in which simulation can make sense without computers?
I think it would have to be like a simulation of what, right? Because we're familiar with computer simulated worlds, which are simulations of this world done, you know, digitally, by computers, by computer programmers. So that is like the concept. I'm sure you can do something else, but I'm not sure what it would be a simulation of. Like, is it a simulation of another realm? And in what sense do we mean simulated then? So I don't know. Yeah, you might be able to do it, but you'd have to let me know.
Yeah,
I'm thinking
because technically when we think about computers, it's like the next step in evolution. By the way, I don't mean that in the biological sense of like imagination, the evolution of imagination, right? It's like, well, before we had computers or whatever like that, there's imagination. Even a child growing up, they have imagination, right? Yeah. Very early on. And then maybe they learn to write and draw and do all sorts of stuff. And then what they'll do is they'll take their imagination and put it down into paper. Yeah. Or whatever. And then now the progression of that has been putting that into a digital format.
Yeah. I wonder if that's a progression or a regression, because if you think about like your imagination, I can imagine some crazy stuff.
Correct.
I couldn't draw it though. You know, I couldn't draw it with the detail. Or if you simulate it in a computer, you're going to have to still generate rules or work within whatever rules that's true. Working on, right? So I think it,
like your imagination is more free, is what you're saying?
I think so, man. I think you're more powerful in your imagination. Like that might be it. You know, that might be like
else,
most powerful.
I suppose it's like, it's the way maybe Plato thought about this. It's like everything else is some kind of a distortion of.
Yeah. Like, unless, okay. Sense. Okay. But you'd have to, okay. There, it depends on what aspect you're looking at and whether you're ranking it and how you're ranking it. Because if you're looking at like a computer simulation, you and I can go into the simulated world and interact together in this other world. And we can't do that in our imaginations. Unless maybe I was talking to you, but I'd still have to depend on your imagination to be as sharp as mine or mine as sharp as yours while we're talking. So I don't know. It depends on how we're comparing them, I guess. Yeah.
Okay. So back to when we're talking about God and Christian theism. So, okay, you say, hey, granted, man, let's just say you're right. Where do you go from there?
Yeah, so I like to, I like to have these types of conversations. I still maintain that machine functionalism is false. I don't think that I'm a digitally simulated being. The only way I think I could be is not if machine functionalism is true, but if substance dualism is true. I think if substance dualism is true, then I think there's probably some psychophysical law that connects our soul to our body when the sperm meets the egg. So if that, I think there's some kind of law there, unless you think God like zaps the egg each time, he could, but he could have some kind of law. So let's just say that it's the second one. It's the law one. I know it might sound like deism and it might sound like he's not knitting us together in our mother's wombs. He could still do that and still have some kind of policy or law that is probabilistic, because actually, you know, not every time a sperm meets an egg, a life is produced. Sometimes they just don't, there's no life there and they don't, the egg doesn't divide. But it could be 90% or something like that. I don't know. God could have set that up. If there's some kind of law like that, I think you can hack onto that law by accident or on purpose and do that in a digital realm. And maybe a soul gets attached to this simulated being. So if substance dualism is true, then maybe we can have digitally conscious beings. It's not because, you know, AI is conscious, but it's because you hacked onto God's laws and you made, you know, a soul was added to a digital being. Yeah. What do you think about that? It's crazy, right?
That's interesting. Yeah. I was like, where's he going with this?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and so I got here kicking and screaming because I was talking with a lot of substance dualists actually, who are like, yeah, you know, this is actually only true if substance dualism is true, or not only if, but it actually makes more sense on substance dualism. Like, dang, that's crazy to think about. So like, if that's the case, man, and I'm not saying it's super plausible. I'm just saying if that is the case and you and I live in a computer simulation right now, I think substance dualism has to be true then. And I think that our simulators hacked onto the laws of, you know, psychophysics, and we are just digitally conscious, ensouled beings.
Would and, it, is it necessarily, yeah. Is it necessary to divide, like we're talking about God and then our simulators and then like get rid of the middleman, right?
Like the, oh, you want to get rid of the simulators?
Yeah. Let's just, they'd be like, we trash the simulators, right? Because I see them as like unnecessary sort of.
Yeah, but then we'd want to, they are necessary. And especially when you're comparing theism and substance or and simulation hypothesis, it's unnecessary because you have this middleman. I have two theories and they're both explaining the exact same thing. So one of them has less, you know, ontological bloat. So just cut that off. That's like, you know, simplicity 101, you know? So that's where, that's ultimately where I go.
But I'm God, just saying, God is the simulator.
Yeah, but so I would just say theism is true and simulation hypothesis is extra that we don't need, because then also you don't need God to create a computer and then create us, right? So then we wouldn't be a simulation. We'd just be the, we'd just be base reality.
Yeah. Makes
but
sense.
If so, that's like, you know, theoretical virtue stuff. That's when you're comparing different theories. But let's just say it is the case that we are digitally conscious beings. And we are ensouled algorithms, maybe. Like, I think we'd be made in God's image still then, because our simulators hacked onto the laws that produce a human soul in a physical body. So now we're a human soul in a digital body. And so what? What matters most about us? Well, it's our soul that matters. I'm not saying like our bodies don't matter at all, but our soul is who we are and what we are. Maybe you don't think that, I don't know, but
this is interesting. So I actually think that God always intended for us to be ensouled,
embodied.
Yeah, sorry, embodied. Always intended for us to be embodied, and
that's for sure, even, I'm with you on that.
Yeah, and even the future of the Christian view of the end is we're still embodied.
Yeah, for like, sure. Yeah, new heavens, new body.
Correct,
it's gonna be great.
Yeah.
Do you believe in a disembodied intermediate state?
I tend to. I'm not necessarily convinced that.
I'm gonna have to call up JP. We're gonna get JP on the call.
Yeah, I'm terrified. He'll like smack me. But he's like, you idiot.
You could go with emergence though too, right? Like if you hold to an emergent theory of mind, that you know, this configuration of matter produces a mind that emerges up at a different level, so you get to have your libertarian free will still. If there's some kind of law that governs that, then you can just make that a digital law, and now the mind is is it supervening? I guess it's kind of supervening. I know that language is ambiguous. It's like a supervening instead of on a physical substrate, just on a digital substrate.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you can still be, you know, an emergent mind theorist, but just in the digital world. Correct. And maybe your mind goes when the algorithm dies or whatever, right? Or is busted up.
Yeah, somebody accidentally drops it.
Right, yeah.
What does physical mean in the simulation is a question that was just asked.
Yeah, I don't know, dude. I don't know what physical means in base reality, if we are in base reality, right? Like physical, I don't know what that means anymore. Physics is insane. Like, is it a superstring? Is it information? Is it mathematics? Like, you get down to that level and you're like, I don't know if you can call an electron physical. Like, is it a probabilistic, like, place? Is it a wave? Is it a particle? I just don't know. So that's a point that David Chalmers makes in this paper, The Matrix as Metaphysics, where it's like, whatever we get down to at the bottom, if it turns out to be zeros and ones, would that be any more surprising than, like, a superstring? Like, it's all surprising, crazy, weird stuff at the bottom. So, like, if our reality is a digital one and it's made up of zeros and ones instead of superstrings, like base reality is, like, okay, so what? You know, like, that's crazy, but it's all crazy. Everywhere you go when it's down at the bottom, it's nuts. So, I don't know. I don't know what physical is.
Yeah. That's funny. Yeah. Like,
that's what the idealists say. The idealists will be like, look, dude, I'm more acquainted with my thoughts than I am with whatever is physical. My thoughts are immediate. I can't escape my own thoughts, but you could tell me a completely different story about the physical world, and it sounds just as plausible as that guy's story. So I have no clue, man. It's more plausible for me to believe in thoughts than it is for me to believe in like physical things. Seems crazy, but
how do we deal with I guess scripture? So I can see how I would have a number of, like, philosophically, this is intriguing, it's fun.
Sure.
It's challenging in all sorts of different ways. Biblically, I'm looking at like hermeneutics, proper interpretation, whether people are kind of pulling stuff out of context that they shouldn't, or maybe maybe it's one of those things. It's like math, you know, you're not going to see much of it in the Bible. And somebody could say it's just one of those things, Arthur, like deal with your biblical texts, but the stuff we're talking about is beyond that. And have you seen anybody deal with kind of the hermeneutical aspect of this approach?
Well, I've heard you mentioned, I don't know if it was a German scholar, but, you know, in the beginning was the word, was the Logos. Correct. I've heard stuff like that. I might've heard that exact same thing actually, but, I don't know if that is like, that sounds like a univocal understanding of information and Logos. And I don't know that God spoke creation into being. Did he use words? Like, he says by his word, but that was referring to the second person of the Trinity.
Right.
Not like, so I think that has to be analogical, because God doesn't have vocal cords the way we do, right? So he doesn't speak the way we speak. So yeah, if you try to shoehorn it in too much and make it like univocal, it's going to fall apart, and it's going to stretch like your credulity. You're going to be like, dude, you lost me. I don't think that the Bible is saying this.
We don't know what we're talking about.
Right. Like, what the heck here?
Those meaning and stuff. Yeah. I mean, it's all theology, you know, all theologians realize that there's a great deal of anthropomorphic language within scripture.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're not literally speaking about, you know, X, Y, and Z.
Yeah. But so if we're living in a computer simulation, like, I actually want to hear from you on this. Like, do you think that Christ's atonement, if it took place in base reality, would cover digitally simulated beings?
It's funny. So let me address this with something. I was in a conversation about aliens the other day with a friend.
Exactly, and, dude. That's right. It always goes to aliens as well. It's great. It's really good to think through.
That's immediately like where it connects to, because I was saying, let's just say aliens exist. And then my friend was saying, well, what does atoning work apply to them? And I was like, well, why are we even assuming that these aliens sinned in the first place?
Exactly, right.
Let's, like, even if they did, let's just say they did. Would that mean that Christ would have some kind of an incarnation in that world or whatever like that?
Yeah.
It seems to me that the Bible is just concerned about humanity.
Right.
And the atoning work is specific to humanity. Now, I can explain that very simply by saying, look, we already have alien beings in the Bible.
Angels.
By that, I mean angels.
Yeah, non-human intelligence, right?
And Christ didn't die for them. Like, It seems to be pretty obvious that the death of Jesus is just applied to humanity as opposed to non-human entities that God has created. And by the way, some of those have sinned, right? Some of those rebelled against God. Why couldn't that be the same when it comes to, you know, aliens on other planets? So I would just apply that same sort of thinking to base reality and simulation.
Well, but so I think it would depend on, I love that. It doesn't mean Christ couldn't go to Alpha Centauri and like, you know, incarnate there, right? Or if he wanted to just say like, no, look, my sacrifice was enough, I'm going to apply it to them as well. Like, who am I to be like, no, God can't do that? There are, in theology, people will say, whatever Christ doesn't assume, he doesn't save. And so, like, if he didn't assume a Alpha Centaurian nature, then he can't save that. And it's like, well, that's a nice platitude, bro, but, like, that's not biblical. I don't see...
Unless I would say that those beings are also created in the image of God, whatever image of God means.
Exactly, right. So that's another point. So this is why now we're into a theology conversation, and it's amazing because we just lured the student in to talk about this. But it's philosophical theology thinking through, like, well, is there a category of image bearer of God that is multiply realizable? I'm a human being, but the Alpha Centaurian, he's also an image bearer of God because he perform certain functions, which probably not right, because then some human beings aren't image bearers of God. But whatever you, however you pick out image bearer of God, why could that not be multiply realized in aliens and, you know, all sorts of other things? And if that's the case, couldn't he just have died here on Earth for everyone else? Or if he chose to incarnate there, like, well, Christ sat at the right hand of the Father, his work is finished. And it's like, yeah, but he's addressing us. What if his work isn't completed over there? Is he not an omniscient being or omnipresent being? Could he not multiply incarnate?
Yeah.
But it seems like he is seated and it seems like it's finished. So, okay, that's cool. But we got to argue for it. You got to give me some arguments and some reason. I don't know if there's aliens. I don't think there are. I'm pretty
agnostic on it, so...
Yeah, if there are, though, that's not a problem. And like you said, like, why assume that they sinned? Like, we sinned, but why assume they did? Like, we have to ask them. Like,
or can you have intelligent aliens that are that have a different sort of soul? Like, so I tend to think that animals have souls, and probably wouldn't say like ants and mosquitoes or, you know, spiders, sure. But obviously they're different sort of souls. They're not human souls. I think animals have a certain kind of intelligence and reaction. I don't want to define every single one of these terms because we won't get anywhere, but, can you have a highly intelligent animal from a different planet? Right. Like the way we're thinking about AI right now, like, is that intelligent or not? Like, you know, like something that can function in a certain way. Without us having to think about like sin, rebellion against God, forgiveness, redemption for them,
right? Yeah, and it seems like not being possible. It seems like that's totally possible. My question remains about the simulated beings like us. Like, if you and I right now are living in a computer simulation, it seems to me like we are made. We would be image bearers of God. In the same sense that base reality humans are. So I don't see why it wouldn't be like transitive, because the only way we got here is if we like hacked the psychophysical laws that produce regular humans. So like, why not? Like, you ever seen the movie Tron, like the second one, Tron, I don't know, Rebirth or something like that?
I think so. Pretty recently, as a matter of fact.
I love Tron, dude. That's a good one. They, you know, pull on evolution a little bit, but, there's these like beings in this digital world that just evolve and they're just there now. And they don't explain them. They just go, like life finds a way kind of thing. But then she, only one of them survives. And, the son leaves with her and goes back to base reality. And she's just a regular human, like just like him. She evolved in the digital world and just left that world behind and went to base reality. So like, I don't want to say breed or copulate. Could he like marry her and produce children? It seems like it, right? It seems like she's just, so if human beings are like a natural kind, then it might not matter how you got there as long as you realize that natural kind, right? So she was like human beings and natural kind. She was produced in a different way than he was. If you go with evolutionary history or whatever, they have way different evolutionary histories and yet they're the same thing. They ended up in the same place.
Correct. I was thinking, I suppose there's something about Wolverine just popped up in my head. the Logan movie, because, you know, it's like, is that his daughter or is it not? Like, they're calling her, but she's essentially a clone.
Well, think about if there's this is like a neo-Aristotelian take on like species and stuff, and sometimes they'll use this argument. But like, if you go to an alien planet and you discover this big giant cat with stripes, and it's orange and black and it looks exactly like a tiger, and you look at their like DNA and it's tiger DNA, like, would you not call that a tiger just because it has a different history than the tigers on our Earth? No, like it's just a natural kind that, you know, that's a tiger. It's just a tiger on a different planet. So that's kind of what I'm thinking. Like, we are still a human being or image bearer. We just have a different way that we got here. I think we still have a soul, right?
That seems pretty consistent. Trying to find some kind of an inconsistency there, but that's
and so like at the inconsistent. Yeah, and I'm just I want to pull on people's intuitions and be like, look, you got to explain to me why that would be a problem there. Now there's other, like, if God is, if you're saying God is just a computer programmer that's like a human being and one level lower, that's a huge problem. But if you're saying like Christianity is somehow false because I'm a digital being, no, that doesn't seem to follow.
Yeah, so I suppose this takes us like even to think about like Plato and the Demiurge and stuff like that, where it's like, yeah, you get this like ultimate reality who doesn't, like the ultimate one who doesn't really interact with reality because reality is all messed up and stuff. Yeah. So I still don't get how these ancients like just would say stuff like, well, that just necessitates a lesser being, you know, like the kind of this Gnostics did this. And they're like, Pam, Demiurge, this is the creator God. Then I would say that's a wrong image of the biblical God.
Yeah.
This naturally necessitated deity is not what the Bible tells us about God. So it's wrong. I would say the same thing about someone who says, yeah, well, God is this like really highly evolved human that,
right,
you know, generated this the simulation. I would say, well, okay, now that is not orthodox anymore.
Right.
It's not,
right.
I could call, very calmly say that's not Christian and can't fit into Christianity.
Yeah.
But if they talk about the same way we talk about God and then God somehow generating, let's just say whatever, however his mechanism is to generate. I don't know if there's issues with that.
Right. Yeah. And if we do live in a computer simulation and the Bible is true of base reality, then like that God who exercises dominion over base reality creation, would he not exercise dominion over simulated creation as well? Like even if it's secondary through his simulator, like that God's still sovereign over all of it. Like it's not like there's a new realm where God isn't sovereign over it.
Correct.
So there's another one. So I don't want to convince anyone that we do live in a computer simulation. Ultimately, I think it's not true and I'm trying to develop arguments against it. But first, I like to just let people think through it. Like, well, you help me out. Help me see why this is at odds with Christianity. And then at the end of the day, I want to say, ultimately, I think Christian theism is a better explanation for our existence and our consciousness. And, you know,
would you say it's better because it's simpler? Is that the route?
That's a big part of it, right? Because if they do explain the same things, but one is more parsimonious, then that's a better explanation. Like, just by definition, just cut that second one off. I also want to think, I think that there's maybe like a transcendental refutation of simulation hypothesis somewhere. Part of me thinks that you can't come to find out that you live in a computer simulation because it seems like there's a problem with that. Like if you go in for semantic externalism, if you think that you need to interact with something, you have to have some kind of causal interaction with something in order for your concepts to refer to it, then you can't think that you live in a computer simulation because you're saying like, I have this concept about base reality and it actually refers to base reality. You're like, well, no, you don't. You never interacted with base reality. You're a digitally simulated being. What are you talking about? Or if you come to believe that, okay, I live in a computer simulation, well, then you should probably think that all of your other beliefs are non-veridical because your concepts of computers and simulations don't refer to computers and simulations. They refer to a fake computer and a fake simulation.
Correct.
So that,
I mean, this is the way I after years and years, I've interpreted the Matrix series as this, because I tend to think that Zion is not real. It's in the Matrix.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And I didn't think that for a while, and then I sat down and thought, I was like, wait, they are saying that. That's the hack.
Yeah.
It keeps, the Matrix is actually generating Zion as well. So all the stuff Morpheus was talking about, reality and all that stuff, is actually another level within the simulation.
How could you ever trust that you left the Matrix? You'd be like, well, look, now I'm here. And it's like, well, no, you thought that last time. Your whole life was a simulated world. You thought that you were in base reality. Why think that you are now? Like, you've been systematically deceived before. I'm not sure how you could ever, like, trust your senses again.
which is what the movie Inception, right? Like has that little token thing they use to tell whether they're in reality or not. Like you don't have that basically is what you're saying.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. I'm trying to come up with an argument for it. I think that maybe like a necessary condition of being rational is like being able to trust your reasoning or your knowledge faculties. And I think that if you come to believe you live in a computer simulation, you have a reason either to not trust your reasoning faculties or your knowledge faculties. You have a reason to either not trust them or you have a reason to think that it's inscrutable whether you should trust them or not. And therefore, if it's inscrutable, then it's not antitrust, it's just not trust. And so then, like, you couldn't believe that you live in a computer simulation because it's leading you to not trust your reasoning faculties. Well, why think it leads you to not trust your reasoning? Because you have one belief that discredits all your other beliefs. The one belief is, I live in a computer simulation. So, like, all your other beliefs are about, like, I live in Illinois, I live here, I'm sitting in a chair, and all those things are actually not true qua base reality. Mm-hmm. They're true maybe qua the simulation, but they're not true qua base reality. But then you have this base reality belief that comes in and wrecks all your other beliefs. That's kind of the neighborhood of the argument. I'm trying to fine tune it, and I think it's going
to
get really
good
technical.
One because you need to you need to have an understanding of these things in order for you to speak about them. I mean, we just spoke about how computers have given us the tools, right, to be able to speak about these things. But even the computers we're talking about, like you were saying, the computers we're talking about are not real.
Yeah.
They're part of this.
James Anderson I really love this dude. He's a reformed philosopher. He came up with a similar argument that it's probably a little bit tighter than mine, but it might not have the same scope, which he's told me it's cool. We talk about it, but he targets Bostrom's simulation argument that I brought up earlier. Bostrom's argument, his motivation for saying that, proposition 3, that we do live in a simulated world. Part of his argument is just look at the technological advancement of the last 50 years. Now run that another 50 years ahead of us. Doesn't it seem like we'll have the technological sophistication to create these things? Yeah, it seems like that. So Anderson's point is, wait a second. If we do live in a computer simulation, then none of our technological advancement is veridical at all. So why should I trust that and use that in my reasoning to project into the future? Yeah. Right? So it's like Wittgenstein's ladder. It's like I use this reasoning process. I reason through the technological advancement of the last 50 years. But actually, once I get to the conclusion, I realize that that wasn't technological advancement at all. That was just a simulation. And what if you guys like artificially worked that, you know, like what if the simulation's only 5 seconds old with the appearance of age? Like,
correct.
All these what ifs jump in and it kind of erodes the reasoning process that got you.
Or like we think we have all the advancements and you had hit a reset button and the next thing you know, we're in like prehistoric times or something.
Yeah. And so you do need to be careful in reasoning through the simulation hypothesis, not to accidentally cut off theism, because, you know, it does get kind of fishy and you go like, I don't want to make an argument that actually undercuts like God's ability to reveal to me that I live in his world. Right. Could God do that? Okay. Well, God's a necessary being. There's a good distinction. I think God's necessarily good, whereas a simulator wouldn't be, and he could, you know, lie to me and do all sorts of other stuff or mess up. I don't think God could mess up. So it's fun to be thinking through this as even like a philosophical theologian or just theologian in general. Like it's fun because it helps us think about God and thinks about maybe the necessity of revelation.
Correct.
Like maybe, you know, if God didn't reveal himself to us, could we have thought about him if we didn't have any causal interaction with him? I don't know. I'm not sure if our concepts would refer to God or not, if he didn't reveal himself.
Yeah.
Or, you know, evidence of evidence is evidence. Maybe my testimonial witness that I have from someone who has witnessed from someone all the way back to Christ, maybe that's enough for my concepts to refer to Christ or something. So it's goofy, man. It's silly, but it's fun. It's fun thinking through.
Correct. I want to jump into some of the comments here before, as we come. We've been on an hour and 15 minutes, man.
Oh, man. We've been crushing
it's like, we're flying.
Yeah.
we're nerding out here.
That's right.
What would be the difference between a computer simulating a non-physical reality and God's mind simulating a non-physical reality without a computer?
Yeah, I actually just did a podcast episode on this with two leading scholars. It's awesome. It's coming out probably at the end of this week. But one would be, maybe you think God's a perfect being, and maybe you think since he's perfect, he'd have to create a perfect world, but you don't think that the concept of perfect world is coherent. So God couldn't create an external world. So he would have to create if he wanted to create, he could at best create a world in his mind, not because he's limited, but because actually he's limited by his perfection. So that might be one reason to say that God created a world in his mind rather than a simulated world outside of his mind. But on the contrary, it's like, look, if you're a Christian or even an Orthodox Jew or something like that, like you probably want to say that the world doesn't exist in God's mind. And so you might prioritize the historical evidence of, you know, the fathers or, you know, Maimonides or something over against the idealist view. So it depends on your evidence and how you're weighting your evidence, probably, whether it's philosophical or whether it's historical or whether it's biblical, or I think that's going to do a lot of the determining. Yeah.
Okay. Dan says, could the image bearer of God be the soul? What seems like that's connected in there somewhere, somehow.
Yeah, I think it is. It depends on like whether you think a soul like necessarily takes a body or whether it can exist disembodied in a disembodied form. But I think that essentially like we are our souls. And I kind of think whatever our soul attaches to, like in whatever our soul informs becomes our body. So I don't know, man, that's a weird view, but I think God could put my soul on a desk and that desk would become my body. So I don't know. Yeah.
We're just going to not continue that conversation.
That's good.
No, there's a lot of questions here. Okay. So thanks for jumping on. Someone that subscribed didn't know why. Now they know why.
Nice.
I like that. Let's see. Christian said, tuned in for theology/apologetics, getting my mind blown about one of my favorite movie franchises, Zion is the Matrix.
That's so good. I love that.
Glad to help. Want to get into... Okay, here's a question. Tom says, what if we are actually the digital beings of another digital being of species?
Yeah.
I think that's the direction we're going into. Like, you'd never know.
Yeah, I think that's true. If you can make one, then why can't that simulated world create simulated worlds? And that's actually part of the motivation for Bostrom's simulation hypothesis in his simulation argument. Basically, he's saying, look, if we can create these simulated worlds, then the majority of beings with conscious experience like ours would be digital. Why? Because our simulated worlds would create simulated worlds, which would create simulated worlds, which all the way down, there would be billions and billions and billions and billions of digital beings, and only what, like 8 billion of us here on base reality. And so you just use this thing called a indifference principle. It's a bland indifference principle. Basically, if most things are X, then I'm probably X. So if most things are digitally conscious, then I'm probably digitally conscious. And so you just go with this like raw, this like probability argument, and you're like, yeah, maybe I'm a digital thing. I'm probably a digital thing if those exist. So then I just think like the transitivity goes all the way through. If base reality things are image bearers of God and we're made in the image of the image bearer of God, then I think the image of God shoots right through.
Correct.
Maybe I mean, not, but I need an argument.
Well, no, I suppose that's essentially like the way that the genealogy stuff sort of works in the Gospels, like Jesus is so on and so forth, and Adam was the son of God, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, you might argue, well, he's like still in a biological line, and we're like breaking the biological line. But I'm thinking about imaging, like, so if I have a mirror in front of me, that's my image that's in that mirror. Now, if I turn it this way, and I look at this other image, I'm seeing, I don't know, I'm trying to think of through, but so let me just say that I'm looking at an image of my image because I set the mirrors up in that way. Mm-hmm. That's still my image in that second mirror, even though that mirror is reflecting another mirror.
Yeah.
But what's it reflecting? Whatever that mirror has in it, which is me. So I can still look over there and see that's me being reflected of a reflection. That's kind of what I'm thinking.
It's pretty clear, I think, that when we talk about image of God, that we're not talking about in the biological sense.
Yeah, right.
Because God didn't biologically produce humanity.
Right, right.
So it has to be something beyond that. I tend to think it's a combination of a number of things, one of them being actually like ruling and reigning, as Psalm 8 says. I think that's image language in Psalm 8, the way Psalm 8 is explaining everything.
It's also beyond that.
It's not just that.
Notoriously tricky, right? Because you don't want to exclude human beings that we recognize, like, dude, that is an image bearer of God, but they don't have the right functioning or something like that. No, you can't do that, right?
Correct.
So it's super tricky.
Yeah. Let's see. Sort of similar to trivialism and radical skepticism. There's not really any arguments against them, but that's not a good reason to believe them.
Yeah. So I didn't lay out Bostrom's like argument super well, but he does give reasons to think that you probably live in a computer simulation, which is different than just like, it could be, right? Like it could be that you're a brain in a vat. And it's like, yeah, but do I have any positive reason for thinking that? And you go, no, it could be. And you go, fine, then I don't believe it. Bostrom saying like, no, here's some positive evidence for you. Unless you can say that we won't ever create these simulated worlds with simulated conscious beings, or you think that we won't do it for moral reasons, which no way. Just think about the AI arms race right now, where it's like, it seems like a really dangerous thing, but everyone just running towards it. Full speed ahead. Like,
hey guys, this might really, really be bad.
No, because it's bad for the stockholders too, right? Like I'm a capitalist. I love me some capitalism, but it might kill us all here. So you probably don't have good reasons to affirm one or two. So you got to affirm three, because it looks like they're mutually exclusive and jointly exhaustive. But you might just affirm one and be like, look, I don't think that you can have a digitally conscious simulated being. So sorry.
Arnold says, thanks for introducing me to James Anderson. I just skimmed through one of his papers on reformed epistemological arguments, and it's great.
Hey, the dude's a beast, man. He's definitely underrated.
Did you just interview him with him?
Not recently, but I have two. Yeah, I have at least two, and I think he might be set to come on soon. He's a monster, man. He's so good. Yeah.
And yet some say reformed epistemology isn't respected in the scholarly circles. Have those some people heard of Alvin Plantinga?
Yeah. I mean, it's not an epistemology today, and I've learned that the hard way, because I've studied, like in my theology classes, I would take a lot of like philosophy of religion from theologians who I love, who are great people. But in those classes, all the students, we were all obsessed with Plantinga. And then I would talk with like secular epistemologists about it, and they'd be like, wait, are you talking about like Plantinga's stuff? Oh, I haven't talked about that in like 20 years. And like, oh, dang it. I guess they don't, you know, so it depends. Yeah. Philosophy of religion, for sure, 100%. Like raw, just secular epistemology. I've definitely looked like an idiot talking to them about it here and there, but whatever. It doesn't mean it's wrong, you know?
Yeah, they'll come around, maybe.
Yeah.
At least, I mean, you got to deal with it. But
for sure.
Let's see.
Oh, wait. So actually, with the planning a proper function stuff, whether that's true in base reality or not, I think something like that has to be true of the simulated world, because someone designed these beings to reason within this cognitive environment that they made, right? So actually, one of my arguments against simulation hypothesis, I just call it like improper function. It's planning has like these three conditions, right? You have to have your cognitive faculties must be properly functioning in the environment they're made for and aimed at truth to, you know, reliably bring you to truth. Mm-hmm. And I think that truth condition is not met in the simulation hypothesis, because your cognitive faculties are aimed not at truth, but at the simulated world, simulated truth or whatever. So why think that it can bring you to real truth when it comes to believing that you live in a computer simulation? So I just call it improper function.
Essentially, that's one of the, sort of connected to this comment that was made. It says, in this view, it's possible then that other humans are just non-player characters in this MMORPG.
That's what, yeah, massively.
This is a gamer. He knows what's going on. He knows.
That's right. Yeah. That's so good. I should have had that queued up. That can be true whether we live in a computer simulation or not, though, right? Like, you could be a philosophical zombie. I have no idea. I mean, I have an idea, right? But it's by analogy, or it's by inference. It's not by direct awareness. I know that I'm conscious. I can't not know that I'm conscious. But like, I don't know. What if you're an android, like really cleverly designed android or something? I don't. So it's a problem of other minds, right? So everyone else could be a NPC but me, which is scary.
Yeah, or you know, it's weird because this argument could go in a way where every single one of us has his or her own universe that is specifically designed. So every, like, you're the only real person.
Yeah. It's what's that movie with Jim Carrey?
Oh yeah. Oh man. The one where he's in the TV show.
Truman Show.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is a ripoff of Philip K. Dick, Time Out of Joint.
Correct.
But yes, that could totally be the case.
Correct. Okay, we're coming to the last of these comments, guys. I think he may have slightly misunderstood my earlier comment about tribalism and skepticism. I was saying that there aren't really any good arguments against the simulation theory.
Oh, I don't know. I think there are some good arguments against it, like arguments against the philosophy of mind. Like, if it's committed to machine functionalism, I think machine functionalism is false. So therefore, boom. If you're pitching it as like we're a brain in a vat, well, then it goes back to brain in a vat skepticism, and you can either deal with it or not deal with it, you know, in the same way that you do with BIV. Yeah, I think there's reasons to think there's like explanatory virtue type arguments where you're like, look, I'm just going to use an inference to the best explanation and say it's not a better explanation than naive realism or base reality realism. So I think that there, I'm not sure that it is in, what do the logical positivists say? They say it's not falsifiable. I don't think it's like not falsifiable in the way that brain in a vat is not falsifiable. I think you can falsify simulation hypothesis, maybe. Yeah.
Okay.
I could be wrong. I don't know. Maybe you can disprove me in the comments. I'd love to hear it.
There's a YouTube channel called Archaics. He goes so deep with chronology, loop destruction, event based on all our calendars. Essentially saying like these floods were resets of all our calendars, and then the ancient world has like been brought in. Yeah.
I don't think you'd need that though, right? If we're in a computer simulation, you'd have to simulate a flood when you could just go like hard reset.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Every time I'm having an issue, I uninstall.
It's generate flood to
Christian says those that aren't elected in Calvin's viewpoint, aren't they just NPCs? Mostly joking, but makes you think.
No, like an NPC, presumably there's nothing that it's like to be an NPC, but there's only something that it's like to be a playable character, because it's whatever it's like to be you playing that character. So like, no, like the unelect would not be.
Correct.
Yeah, non-conscious beings.
By the way,
like
that's interesting in the sense of like it would make the hell view pretty soft. Like you really.
Yeah, there's no suffering. Yeah. But then it would also diminish like God's wrath, right? Towards sin and stuff too. Yeah. So it would undercut that. Yeah.
Cool, man. Y'all got a lot of stuff to think about. I know I do. This is fun, Parker.
This was really fun,
dude.
We
can sit here and talk for next, 2-3 hours.
Yeah,
I do have to moderate a debate for high school students.
Okay.
At 5.
Nice.
So this is maybe a good way to get everything, to get the gears rolling.
Yeah.
I want to end this by you touching up on your, this video I just saw on reading. I thought, what you did is, I'll tell you why. I got my son. My son is turning 9 this month, actually in 4 days. Nice. He's a reader. He's an avid reader. And we didn't, like, we sort of worked at it, but the kid really loves reading, so we just let him read. Last year, he read, like, 90-something books. Nice. And now, for his age, like these books tend to be, like, 170, 230 pages, and that he's just getting more. He's pretty good at reading. The way you broke down the numbers, and then you're like, hey, man, that's, like, 52 pages a day.
Yeah.
It's pretty manageable, or whatever, 30 pages a day. I thought that was really good. And then you have this specific thing you do with your journal, writing it down. Give us a little breakdown. We'll end it on that.
Okay.
Because that's just really good advice, because it helps people kind of break it down and just into bite-sized pieces and say, I can really have a schedule on reading and get through a bunch of books.
Yeah. Oh, well, so it's just pretty basic math. I still have to use a calculator because I'm a soft science guy. I'm not...
Yeah, me too, man.
Yeah. But... this is just stuff that I picked up along the way, because I was a pretty bad reader. I was fast and stuff. I always did well, like in grade school. They were like, "Oh, you're a good reader," but then I never did it. So by the time I got to high school, like I could not finish a book, and I would fall asleep. I'd get really groggy, and I like would straight up drool on my books in college and stuff because I'd fall asleep. So I had to like really work at it, like I did with wrestling. So I just took the same approach. I make goals in wrestling. I make goals in lifting. So I'm gonna make a goal in reading. I'm going to see if I can read 10 pages without falling asleep, five, you know, and just work at it. So then I started doing some math, and I don't know if I got it from like John Piper. Someone explained a little bit about like just being consistent. So then I looked, you know, I did some math. If you read 15 pages a day, like you could probably read 15. If you're reading like deep philosophy, maybe it's only 5 or 10, whatever, dude. It's up to you, man. It's your thing. If you do that, 15 times 365 is 5,475 pages in a year. Okay. Divide that by, let's say like most books are, let's say like 250. Let's say you're reading books that are like 250. That's 22 books in a year. Yeah. Now, some of you are like, I've never read 22 books in my life. Like, yeah, probably not. If you don't set a goal and get after it, you're not going to, or you're going to be like skimming them really hard in like December, you know, 25th through the end of the year. So just be consistent every day and try and get, 15 pages. If you can read more than that, that's even better. And you will end up reading more. You will start getting better at it and be like, oh, I'm understanding the terms more. Oh, I'm getting faster and I'm understanding what I just read more easily. I don't have to reread the page 6 times anymore. Now it's just 4 times. Now it's 1 time and I get it. And now I can read faster. So it's a muscle like anything else. Just keep working at it. You don't have to like flex on anybody, but it is pretty cool to be someone who reads books. Like it's fun. It's fun learning new things. It's fun. I like physical copies because the way I learn, I have to write down in my books often, and I can remember what side of the page it was on if I made a note. And I don't mean like I can remember the exact. It just helps me remember more than if I'm skimming through on a digital thing. So that's me. Maybe that's not you, but man, make a goal and stick to it. Read some books.
Yeah, I have an idea for you for a YouTube short.
Okay.
Do that same exact breakdown, but with Bible reading.
Okay.
Like, that's good. Because a lot of people struggle reading their Bibles. And maybe it's not good enough to say like, oh, a chapter or whatever like that. It's like, hey, man, if you read this many verses.
Yeah.
But I don't know what the total number of verses in the Bible are, by the way. So you can do the math and break that down and say, if you read this many verses a day, here's the amount of verses you will get done in a year compared to
that. Is good.
I think it'll be very helpful for folks.
Yeah. That'd be really good, man. I'll have to try that out. I'm always trying to balance between like, I still want to get a PhD in philosophy. And some of the secular folks get a little squeamish if they hear that, like, oh, you're into apologetics. Is that, and like, no, dude, I am like trying to be a Christian philosopher and theologian. Yes. Yeah. But, you know, so I'm always trying to balance between like, if I make a YouTube short about how to read your Bible more, is that going to help me not? Is that going to make me not get into a program? Then I'm like, whatever, dude, I don't care. God's sovereign. If he wants me to get into a program, he's going to help me out.
One of the things I've realized, and just talking to folks who've gone into like really awesome schools and ended up getting their PhDs and stuff like that, secular places, Christians. And it's like people just value high academic level work at that level. And they're just going to respect you if you're producing really good academic work, whether you're Christian, whatever, atheist, doesn't matter. I've learned that from the good examples that we have in front of us in regards to Christian philosophy and apologists and stuff like that. The problem becomes when Christians are sort of lazy in their intellectual pursuits and then jump the gun and say, well, this happened and let me quote this Bible verse and stuff like that. And
right. Or no when the
intellectual rigor behind it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my dog's losing it. Oh, well. I feel you, man. And I think that a telltale sign of that is when someone says, that's just this. So if you're talking about panpsychism or simulation hypothesis, and a Christian, a lot of times if they're lazy or scared, a little bit nervous about something, they go, well, isn't that just this? And it's like, no, it's not just that. What? Stop.
Yeah, it's
just think through it. Let's talk. Yeah, let's, you know, take them seriously. It's okay. Yeah.
Well, thanks, man. I really appreciate
this. Great.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, let's run it back.
Other than your YouTube channel and then your blog, your website that I've linked there, where else can folks find you that you're pretty active on and interact with?
Yeah, you can find, I'm going to be more active on the Substack than the blog now. It's just parknotes.substack.com, I believe. That'll have some fun philosophy stuff, my own thoughts. Instagram. I'm on TikTok, unfortunately, but I recognize that God needs people on TikTok as well.
Yes.
I'm trying to protect myself from the CCP, so I'll have it only on my iPad, which is not connected to other stuff. You can find me around. I'm all over the place. I have a Parker's Pensies Penseurs Facebook group where I have a lot of the guests that I have on the podcast. They're in there and we talk. I have a Discord channel. If you guys go to my YouTube channel and click on one of my videos, you can find all the links in the thing. Yeah.
Very nice. Well, hang in there. Let me say goodbye and then, we'll finish this up.
Yep.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much. I mean, we were on for an hour and 40 minutes and we could have been on for another 2 hours because these, discussions are fun. And somebody just told me that the Bible has 31,102 verses. Cool. So we'll do the math and break that down and see where we go from that. I want to thank you guys for hanging out with us. I will see you guys tomorrow for our live Q&A. We do that every Monday and Wednesday. And then we will have another guest on for you next Thursday. Won't tell you who yet, but should be interesting. If you want to support the work we're doing, patreon.com/apologiacenter. It's patreon.com/apologiacenter. We would love your support. And thank you for the prayers. Appreciate all the support. Appreciate you guys being in the chat and just interacting with this material. Take care. God bless you. And we will see you tomorrow.